into a border in the southern United States, between the border between Mexico and the United States. It's late at night. Along one side of the border, on the Mexican side, it is a series of bonfires. Families are standing around the bonfires getting warm. They're tying green garbage bags onto their feet. As you look across, there's floodlights across the other side, and down between the border is a cement a reservoir that has a river sort of running through it. It's sort of slump, more like a trickle of water running through it. On this side of the border, this event and what I witnessed that night, there was a tension in the air, of course, as helicopters flew over above. This was a game that went on every night and probably continues to this day at the border of Tijuana to the United States. Those workers are lining up with their families often to try and make it across the border. They start at times, depending on where helicopters are, whatever, and you sit and you watch this and you're just amazed that you're watching something completely out of your experience. As they try to sneak across the border into the United States, some make it, some don't. Talking to the people across, you have to juxtapose this with what I spent the day doing. The day I spent traveling around with the head of the Human Rights Commission of Baja California, which is Mexico, and visiting factories. And as you travel through the factory zones, they were all, looked like Burnaby or anywhere else. There were curbs, they were paved, and of course there was all these big factories. Oops, technology here. Time's up. Okay, I got it. Anyway, as I was traveling through that, it was very clear to me that this was a booming economic area in Mexico, and that every factory had a help wanted sign, "We need help." So as I said to the workers that night, as we were going around and the fellow was translating for us, I said, "What are you doing risking your life going across this border when you have all these jobs here?" And the range of answers said a lot about how they viewed all those industrial jobs. The first thing was, those jobs are for teenagers. They're not for adults. One of the responses was, why would I work there at $3.50 a day when I can make $20 in a field across the border, working in farm work? And what becomes obvious to you as you describe that is there's something going on in the capitalist system and the development in the world where those folks are actually rejecting the Industrial Revolution that we were part of because it's turning back the clock so far that it's unviable for them economically. And when you walk through the factories and you look at the factories, the front half of those factories is the people from the United States mostly. The quality control department came from the United States and so did, of course, the bosses. They would drive across the border every day in their Mercedes Benzes to go to work. The rest of the factory was Mexican, including, of course, the human resources directors that were there too, to manage the workforce. And then when you walk out of the factories and you walk into the communities, you walk back to the third world. Starting with the door of the factory when you went in, because when you looked around, they were working in third world conditions often. I went to one place that was assembling computers. It was a series of workbenches with benches and about 40 women sitting in this basically concrete room putting together the components for the factory down the street. And when they walked out of there, they walked back to the third world and they walked back to the situation where they had no electricity and no running water in their houses. The infrastructure for workers in that community was non-existent. And so all of those people that were working there and building the computers and the auto parts and all of the things they were making were simply never going to be buying those things. You would never could afford to buy them, and even if you could, you didn't have electricity to run it. And then I thought there was one article in the paper that struck me that day, which was that the local area had decided they wanted to put a 1% tax on output. But don't forget, much of this is created, of course, because they only tax profits. That was the maquiladora's own whole theory. You brought stuff in, you assembled it, you sent it out, and it was outside the Mexican economy and the structures of the Mexican economy. So they said, well, let's put a 1% tax on to build infrastructure for the communities. And of course, the response of the industry at that paper was, well, if you do that, we'll just move. And so that image stuck with me all of my life since then because I realized I live in a global economy, but the global economy that corporations are building these days doesn't work for working people, period. And that underneath that the struggle to improve those conditions, well, it has many similarities to the struggles our forefathers and mothers went through to improve those conditions 100 years ago in Canada and continue to this day in Canada to struggle for it. The context for that conversation, the context for that struggle is very different. It is a global, truly global context. And there's good things about that. There's good things that countries are developing that haven't had a chance to develop. But the bad things about it are that they're developing in such a way that they don't have the conditions in order to advance themselves and to change those. At the same time, the people who fought and struggled for those conditions in our countries are watching the manufacturing sector in Canada disappear. And it is disappearing. 350 to 400,000 jobs are disappearing. And we face a dilemma in Canada. Not only are what happening is the workers going somewhere else, but they were creating an economy without those good paying jobs. And those jobs are being transferred not because of a desire by those companies to develop the third world. They're being transferred by the desire of those companies to exploit the third world and take advantage of two basic things: cheap labor and no environmental standards. And that's the context for this conversation that we're having today about ethical purchasing. The context is a world that has rearranged itself, often through trade deals that we have, often through the global flow of capital. Those trade deals said some basic things. You no longer control what comes into your country to the market, and you no longer control the right to export resources to other countries to do it. For workers, the choices at the bargaining table get starker every day, which is, you can either import their conditions, or we can export your work. That's what we face at the bargaining table all the time. And let's face it, that's simply the race for the bottom. And that's what we're fighting against in the lay moment. We're fighting some days a losing battle with the race to the bottom. And that's why conferences like this and other things are so important, because the labor movement can't do this ourselves. There is a fundamental failure of democracy going on here. There's a fundamental failure of having standards for everybody so that everything we buy is ethical. So that everything we buy, we know the workers are going to work and not being exploited. By whose ever standards? No one would suggest for a second that even though the third world has lower living standards, that the exploitation in Mexico that caused people to risk their lives going across the border was okay, or was a step forward. In fact, it wasn't. And so we need to get back to that conversation about how we rearrange the planet so that we actually have the opportunity to share the resources on this planet and share the work on the planet in a way in which working class people are not competing with each other in a race to the bottom, and we're not paying the price by abusing the planet. That's a huge task, and certainly one the labor movement can't do itself. There's no question about that. And in order to go forward, we have to find ways in which we can put this on the agenda over and over again. I don't believe the only answer is I read every tag on every piece of clothing I buy and everything I buy. I don't think that's a strategy that's viable over the long term. Frankly, many of the things that you wish to buy today, you can't buy made in Canada or made in situations where labor conditions are protected. Now, let me just say, I'm not promoting Canada as the best labor conditions on the planet. I'm wearing a button that says $10 minimum wage. We haven't raised the minimum wage in BC for 8 years. We're talking about everybody and everywhere, because the living standards here are higher. $8 would be great in some countries an hour, for sure. It'd be much better than they're getting today, but it's not a livable wage in Canada. So all of this conversation is in part relevant and relative to where you live and where you have to pay your rent and where you have to buy the food. So I just want to end by talking about ethical purchasing. And I want to say that I don't see ethical purchasing as a single strategy. I see it as part of a much bigger strategy. And that it's an opportunity to open up the conversation, because you can't talk about ethical purchasing without talking about unethical purchasing. Otherwise, why are we having the conversation about ethical purchasing? Why are we even having a conference on it if what's going on in the planet is there's a whole lot of unethical things going on? And how do you change that? Well, that's part of the challenge. I think the kind of stuff that people have been doing, we have to do more of, which is people are taking control of their own lives and their own ways to try to set standards for themselves. Whether it's the people, I believe the last struggle was at York University, where they had a sit-in and sat down and refused to leave until they had an ethical purchasing policy at the university, or whether it's the Olympics, or whether it's city councils, or wherever, it's an opportunity for us to put this agenda item on the broader spectrum for people to think about. It is important and possible to be ethical. And ethical means that we purchase goods from places that respect workers' rights and respect the environment, and respect the self-determination of people to organize and express their own interests. And I believe that that's the opportunity we have with ethical purchasing. Is it part of a bigger conversation we have to have with our own community and with the planet about how we change the way the world works so it works again? And so the Olympics. We had many conversations with the Olympics at the Federation to try to work some of these things out. And frankly, I believe the Olympics have fallen short of a gold standard. I don't think they met the gold standard. In part, Because the way this ethical stuff works is you hire other people to tell you whether you're being ethical or not, and we don't get to see that. They would never be allowed to hand out a gold medal to somebody who won a race if no one could see the race. It would never happen. So why do we allow them to have an ethical purchasing policy that says they can decide it's ethical, somebody can go and analyze that, and we don't get to see it, read it, or hear about it? The first thing about ethical purchasing is it's transparent. We all get to see and make choices about it. And that's really important. Compliance. Compliance is extremely difficult. Extremely difficult. You go into somebody else's country and tell them what to do. That's why there's a lot of suspicions around the compliance and why you have to lay out exactly how that's going to work. The third gold standard, I think, is, and certainly from the layman's perspective, is it would have been nice if the standard was 50% of everything we needed for the Olympics was built in Canada. There are things they're building in Canada, and the things they're having done in China now that can be done in Canada today. Yes, it costs more money, but this isn't about money. It's about a gold standard for human beings. If it's just about money, then just to put the money on the table and call it a day. If Olympics would become totally about money. In fact, Olympics are the possibility for, again, on a world scale, raising this issue. And I'm really happy that that's what's happened, not just in Vancouver, but in Beijing and a lot of other places where people are doing the work necessary to keep the envelope being pushed up. Because we have to have those examples where you can run your world ethically and fairly and respecting workers' rights. And we need more and more examples of that, and Olympics are a perfect one to win. So, they might get a C-plus at the Olympics in British Columbia. I know there's a discussion later on today. We want them to get an A-plus. We want to help them get an A-plus. We want a gold standard that we can all be proud of. And when the Olympics are finally done, we can walk away and say, yes, we feel good not only about the fact we had this huge event, but the fact that we set the bar higher for the rest of the planet on the Olympics on how they treat workers. So thank you all in this room today for what you do. Without you, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Without your commitment, we wouldn't be on the journey we're on, actually, to change the way the world works. So thank you very much, and have a great conference.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim, and we weren't trying to cut you off there, although I've been known to try and do that to Jim once or twice over the years. We were playing with the sound levels here to allow the function next door to be able to function and hear themselves next door.